really nice to see so many of you here today. Most of you aren't even married to me. One or two I've paid. It's a beautiful day. It's a heavenly day. I'm going to be talking about heavenly fictions. The idea of the way in which literature has become sort of fascinated in the last 20 years, or fascinated once more with the idea of heaven, the possibility of eternal life. I'm going to think primarily about the novels of the last 20 years, alongside a couple of cinematic versions of eternity. I'll be talking about visions of heaven in novels by, amongst others, Julian Barnes, Alice Sebold, and finally, Douglas Copeland, and in Powell and Pressburger's extraordinary film, A Matter of Life and Death. But I want to begin by thinking about the literary and spiritual origins of the title of this year's festival, Heaven in Ordinary. It has a literary origin. And in order to do that and to think about heaven and the future, we need to move back in time some 400 years to a short piece of verse written by George Herbert, the great 17th century poet priest. It's called Prayer, and it was published shortly after his death in 1633. This is it. Prayer, the church's banquet, angels' age, God's breath in man returning to his birth, the soul in paraphrase, heart in pilgrimage, the Christian plummet sounding heaven and earth, engine against the Almighty, sinner's tower, reversed thunder, Christ's side piercing spear, the 6 days world transposing in an hour, a kind of tune which all things hear and fear, softness and peace and joy and love and bliss, exalted manner, gladness of the best, heaven in ordinary, man well dressed, the Milky Way, the bird of paradise, church bells beyond the stars heard, the soul's blood, the land of spices, something understood. It's an extraordinary poem. This poem, this prayer, is energized by a vivid awareness of the proximity of heaven to the everyday. It's something that I think the Greenbelt Festival has long been caught up with itself, the interest in that notion of a thin place, the thin division between the everyday and the spiritual, the eternal. It's bursting with images of what he names heaven in ordinary, food, the landscape, the chiming of a bell. Keith Ward, a contemporary theologian who's also speaking this weekend, has argued that eternal life is primarily lived in relation to the eternal, rather than simply life going on forever. And that's an important idea, I think, also for Herbert, and for a number of the writers I'm going to be looking at today. Herbert's poem seems both to embody that idea and to foreshadow in a precise, lyrical, but strangely modern idiom, the hope of a happy afterlife. So the hope of eternal life continues to captivate the literary imagination. I think it's something that's come back much more forcefully in the late 20th century. I guess in the early 20th century, world wars, the belief that progress was collapsing, one vision of the future, the idea that human life itself on Earth was perfectible, came under such pressure that those visions started to disappear. And I think they've come back in different ways, despite us living in many ways in a similarly violent period. How can literature create images of the afterlife without reducing heaven to a series of clichés? Something that Herbert avoids. He talks about the everyday, but there's not a cliché amongst them. This has been one of the fundamental questions to preoccupy theologically charged writing across the centuries. The first great work of prose fiction in the English language, John Bunyan's allegory, The Pilgrim's Progress, published in 1678, describes the journey, as many of you know, from the city of destruction to the celestial Jerusalem. So English prose fiction has always been interested in these kind of ideas. And it's also been interested more widely in ideas of endings. How do worlds come to an end? How do novels themselves end? We might think about the happy end of romantic plots or the cathartic end of tragedies, for example. Literature that's interested in the ends of particular eras. So in the late 19th century, the so-called decadent writers had a strong sense that this was a world that was coming to an end. Writers like H.G. Wells and Oscar Wilde, for example. But the Jewish and Christian idea of a coming kingdom becomes increasingly problematic as that idea of faith as something at the centre of society recedes, becomes changed, in many cases becomes secularised. In an apocalyptic short story entitled How Clear Is Your Vision of Heaven, Douglas Copeland, the Canadian novelist, explores the absence of challenging visions of heaven in contemporary Western culture. This is a quotation from that. The price you pay for your comfort is a collapsed vision of heaven, the loss of the ability to see pictures in your heads of an afterlife. One of the defining theological anxieties of Aria, I think, relates to the loss of traditional pictures of eternity. We no longer have those very ambitious visions. Think about those great paintings you might see if you go around a Gothic cathedral, for example, the great art that was inspired by visions of judgment and also visions of heaven as well. What Copeland calls a collapsed vision of heaven seems for a long time to have dominated. So is it still possible to imagine an afterlife and, for example, the Christian idea of bodily resurrection? In the closing chapter, for example, of David Lodge's Paradise News, a novel that's very much about the idea that we might find heaven on earth, but that idea somehow not being up to much, not being really up to scratch. Bernard Walsh, who's a lapsed theologian, a lapsed Catholic theologian, delivers a lecture on the deterioration of traditional Christian visions of the afterlife. He says this: the question facing the theologian today is, what can be salvaged from the eschatological wreckage? What can be salvaged of our traditional ideas of heaven, in other words? He laments the loss of Christianity's traditional emphasis on a teleological and apocalyptic narrative, a story with a purpose and with an idea that at the end of that story there will be some revelation. Not necessarily a violent end, but some kind of transformative ending in which things that were once hidden will become clear. So he believes that that kind of idea has been lost, has been forfeited by much Christianity. And Lodge's novel contrasts the idea of this earthly paradise, much of it is set as the theologian is on holiday in Hawaii, of heaven today, with a theological idea of a future kingdom of grace and love. And he suggests that the former will always be disappointing, but that the latter has become nearly impossible to believe. So it's quite a sad novel. It's a novel about loss of faith. There's a kind of turn at the end towards that as a possibility. Maybe it's possible to recuperate that. Similarly, I guess, we've lost traditional images of hell, but they've persisted, I think, in a way that images of heaven haven't quite, in very secularised forms, but in very, very forceful forms, and I think forms that aren't really available without the background of the Christian story, if you like. So although hell is no longer necessarily widely believed in, it's the final dwelling place of those souls subject to eternal punishment, it's often used as an epithet for countless bleak and disparate locations on earth. We talk still very much, don't we, about hell on earth in various different ways, much more so than perhaps heaven on earth. We find it easier to create pictures of eternal torment than we do to envisage paradise. These nightmares are frequently replicated for the cinema, appearing, for example, in the filthy battlefields of war movies, in the claustrophobic, deathly spaces that pervade the many subgenres of horror. I guess movies like Hostel and so on have brought that idea very forcefully back, that hell can somehow be lived out on Earth. I was interested to see how many of the top choices in Greenbelt's online poll of books to read before you die, or whatever it was called, a part of the dystopian tradition. Incidentally, how many of you here voted in that poll? Because I think it was quite well subscribed. Not a lot of you here. But a number of them were about hell on earth, if you like. There were those dystopian novels, things like Orwell's 1984, Huxley's Brave New World, both of which were in the top 10, and I think Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale. They're all very popular today. And that mode of fiction emerges as an inversion of Thomas More's 16th century vision of perfect government, the idea of utopia, and a word that's kind of a play on words that literally means nowhere. So it already contains the notion that it's not achievable, but dystopias, their inversion, are much more common. We also got the end of the 19th century in writers like William Morris's great dream vision of the perfect socialist society where there's no work, that kind of utopian and dystopian tradition coming through. But novelists and indeed filmmakers have never quite found an appropriate grammar with which to represent heaven. We're surrounded by violence, abuse, greed, and destruction to such an extent that it becomes a familiar list of images. We're used to them on the nightly news. They become bland. They become overfamiliar. They're part of our everyday life. Again, they're part of our imaginary landscape, aren't they? But the hope of heaven, by contrast, seems, if not quite absurd, then certainly beyond the scope of traditional fiction or traditional cinema, say. Redemption, resurrection, eternal life. All of these terms belong to what's collectively been named the sublime, a form of experience that's unrepresentable or that exists beyond the limits of frail and deceptive language. It's the kind of language that we associate, say, with the Romantic poets, with people like William Blake and William Wordsworth, all of whom were wrestling with the big questions, questions about eternity. The Immortality Ode, for example, by Wordsworth. Blake's whole work was charged with a sense of the divine in the everyday, too. But that term sublime, I think, is important for us. It's something that we can't represent. So if we can't represent it in any meaningful way, what we can do is imagine it, recognising that our imagination has limits. In contemporary Western societies, visions of heaven, even in post-Christian cultures, are dependent, I think, on earlier Christian notions. That is of a shared, if unconscious, notion of the traditional four last things: death, judgment, heaven, and hell. So what place can such ideas find outside of traditional Christian theology? And most of the writers I'm going to look at today, in any detail, wouldn't describe themselves as Christians. Some of them are agnostics, some of them atheists. In the figure of Douglas Copeland, somebody who kind of plays hard to get, though his fiction is phenomenally charged, I think, with a sense of the Christian story of redemption and resurrection in all sorts of ways. Despite that kind of lack of an absolute belief, an absolute faith in those kind of ideas, notions of heaven, I think, have come back even more forcefully and in much more plural ways in recent years. But cultural representations of heaven are always compromised. They're always shaped by the artistic and philosophical constraints of the historical moment. Back in the late 60s, Robert Hughes, an art critic, complained that modern ideas of heaven and hell are diluted. Heaven is vaguely thought of as a stretch of blue sky with pearly gates like those in a hairdresser's movie ad. It's all as clean as the inside of a new icebox. And to anyone with a trace of blood in his veins, it's a prospect of appalling boredom, like being confined forever in Disneyland. Which sounds all right to me, actually. I don't know. Maybe there's something wrong with me. Okay, but now the final chapter of Julian Barnes' History of the World in 10.5 chapters, a really popular novel, the kind of novel that's now taught at A-level and at universities, but a really interesting piece of fiction that starts off with a version of a Genesis story, with a version of the flood, narrated, we later find out, by a woodworm, not by Noah, but by the least of the least. It ends with a kind of a vision of the end of the world, with a vision of heaven. The vision offers a critique of the common idea of heaven as a consumer fantasy, the idea that Robert Hughes there was talking about, this kind of bland, sanitised, kind of, I suppose, movie-like version. It's a kind of Tales of the Unexpected style short story. It's a story with a twist, as so many short stories seem to thrive on. They need that notion of a twist. The narrator wakes up in a world of apparently endlessly fulfilled desires. Anything that he can have, both from the trivial to the major, just seems very easy. He can achieve it. Every meal he can have is his favourite meal, which is a traditional English breakfast. And he can have that without putting on any weight, which sounds great as well, doesn't it? He can also play for his favourite football team, happen to be Leicester City, and they win the FA Cup every season. So you know that this is a kind of a dream. It's a godless, democratic heaven, and it's a parody of what we think we want. It's a dream, to quote the novel, of endless, perfect sex, golf, shopping, dinner, meeting famous people, and not feeling bad. Okay, so that's a kind of litmus, I suppose, of 80s aspirations. It was published at the end of that decade, and I suppose Barnes is tapping into those notions, the kind of greed is good notion, and turning them on their head, because this fantasy quickly turns into a kind of hell. Within this world, hell exists only as a theme park in heaven. You can go to hell if you want to, and people pop out at you and spook you like on the ghost train, but actually it doesn't really exist. Significantly, the dreamer is disappointed. He's disappointed that heaven doesn't really exist, or hell doesn't really exist as he knew it. And he's disappointed at the lack of divine judgment. So his angel tells him, well, look, I can sort this out for you. You can be divinely judged. But that, too, is a kind of disappointment. He's judged by this bureaucrat. He goes to a very nice, book-lined office. Well, the guy isn't terribly interested in him. He's perfectly polite. And the final assessment is, you're okay. It doesn't sound like much compared to those traditional visions of judgment, of the separation of the sheep and the goats. And it's an interesting idea that this guy, who isn't particularly religious in any sense, is disappointed that those old stories have proved false. He meets a host of dead celebrities, statesmen, actors, and so on, but he's discouraged from meeting Jesus. He encounters Hitler briefly and is surprised that Hitler is in heaven, but Hitler too is allowed to be in heaven. So this is kind of a very unsatisfactory version of what heaven should be, according to his version. So what Barnes is doing here is defamiliarizing, making strange, in other words, the everyday concept of heaven. Should heaven be considered a place of eternal reward, or is it just a fantasy of fulfilled desire? Self-gratification is ultimately more like hell than heaven. They can't believe their good luck at first, and then a few hundred years later, they can't believe their bad luck, says one character. Why do we have these dreams of heaven, asks the narrator. Is heaven simply the oldest dream of all, one that humanity is incapable of growing out of? Well, there's another story, more recent, from 2002, a kind of popular and very harrowing novel, a disturbing novel called The Lovely Bones by Alice Sebold. And the narrator of that novel is a ghost from beginning to end. On the first page, she tells you the date in which she was raped and murdered by a neighbour. It's not a happy tale in many ways. But she too ascends to a heaven that looks very much like her version of Earth. It's kind of like suburban America. None of her family are there. Nobody that she knows are there. But the landscape, it's really haunting. It's this series of 1960s-style school buildings, which for her were the buildings that she aspired to going to next as she moved on to high school. So she seems to be limited by the life that she's led before and by those aspirations. Heaven is also godless. There's no sign of God anywhere. It's just almost the next stage. It's almost like evolution. But the novel uses heaven as a kind of conceit, a place from which the narrator can watch the impact of her death on the rest of her family and friends. I don't think The Lovely Bones is a novel all about what heaven is really like. It's about what life on Earth is like. It uses that as a kind of device. But it's interesting that Sebold used that as a kind of device, as a way of opening up the way we live on Earth. And all the miracles that happen on Earth within that narrative. So these rather safe, in some ways, popular visions of heaven, versions that aren't really going to challenge you in some ways. In Barnes's case, the notion of heaven as a consumerist fantasy that ultimately becomes more like hell are not always conformed to by screenwriters and directors. There was a whole slew of films. There's films like Heaven Can Wait from 1978. It's a remake of a 50s film with Warren Beatty. What Dreams May Come with Robin Williams and Cuba Gooding Jr. That pairing should set off alarms, I guess. That it's extraordinarily sentimental, but I did cry a little bit at the end. Dogma, a really scatological, naughty film in which angels are no better than human beings. In fact, they're significantly worse. But a very powerful and interesting take on religious belief and our desire for heaven, ultimately, and for God. And a film based on a Kieslowski script called Heaven from 2002 that has no supernatural elements in it whatsoever until perhaps the very end. But I think that's the most compelling version of a heaven narrative on cinema in recent years. But the best by far of all of these movies is a Powell and Pressburger film called A Matter of Life and Death from 1946, immediately post-World War II. And this film begins with a dying airman, Peter Carter, played by David Niven, you know, the perfect English gentleman. Actually, Billy Bragg's talk this morning should have talked about David Niven. I think he should somewhere appear in Definitions of Englishness with that perfect accent and clipped moustache. He has a dream of heaven that's far more troubling than a conventional sentimental paradise, certainly than any of the texts we've looked at so far. The image of thousands of dead service people, nurses, soldiers, airmen, as they walk, resurrected, The streets of what Ian Christie terms this cool, modernist heaven must have been an enormous visual shock for audiences in 1946. So I guess that cinema audience would have been made up of people who had lost people in the war, perhaps, you know, a member of their family, probably a member of their family, and they were confronted with this vision of resurrected bodies in heaven, filmed for that section in black and white, with a lot of impact. And one of the most striking set pieces in the film is the celestial escalator that connects heaven and earth. In a film littered with literary allusions, Shakespeare and the Romantics and so on, this rewalking of a story of Jacob's dream is one of the only explicit references to the Bible. That reference to Genesis 28. He had a dream in which he saw a stairway resting on the earth with its top reaching into heaven. And we get that vision in the film. It's incredibly affecting. And if you've not seen that film, I feel slightly evangelical about it. You must see it. In fact, maybe we'll do a survey as you go out, and I'll make sure you pledge to see it by this time next year. It is an extraordinary, extraordinary film. In contrast to those consumerist fantasies we'd already talked about, parodied by Barnes, and the uncannily suburban limbo described in The Lovely Bones then, another trajectory in 20th and 21st century fiction demonstrates a yearning for the hope of a transformative future life, one that's going to genuinely change human life in some ways for the better. And that's happened in much fiction of the last 30, 40, maybe even 50 years, maybe post-war, maybe the Second World War in some ways is no coincidence in terms of the kind of literature and film that comes after it. One critic, for example, identifies novels by Kurt Vonnegut, the recently deceased, much-missed Kurt Vonnegut, in his science fiction. Italo Calvino, John Bart, Walker Percy, less well-known novelists, but novelists who've been interested in the four last things, in transformative ideas of what it is to be human, what it is to die as well. Douglas Copeland, I think, continues this tradition, but he recuperates the hope of bodily resurrection. That's something that makes him, if not quite unique, certainly very rare in a kind of secular wasteland, if you like. In one of his recent novels, Eleanor Rigby, Copeland features characters who are troubled by visions of a coming end. Liz Dunn, who's the narrator, has a son who is haunted by strange images of the future, omens, things we see when we're near end times. Liz herself later inherits her dead son's strange gift. And towards the end, when she herself has suffered various different traumas, she takes a painkiller, but she's suddenly transported, and it gives her this extraordinary vision. She has this vision of the wilderness. And this lifelong skeptic briefly becomes a prophet of sorts. She encounters these different figures on a prairie landscape. They asked me, what is our choice? And I said, you have to decide whether you want God to be here with you as part of your everyday life, or whether you want God to be distant from you, not returning until you've created a world perfect enough for him to re-enter. This peculiar dream, in its embrace of pastoral and apocalyptic imagery, reflects Copeland's ongoing interest in the way God is imagined in contemporary culture. Should God, if believed in at all, be considered to be part of everyday life, or is a reserved and remote creator, the kind of deist idea of a creator who sets creation in motion and then has nothing to do with it? Well, Bishop Tom Wright argues that Jewish and Christian cosmology emphasizes that God's space, to use his word, God's space and human space, though distinct, interlock. Heaven, in his vision, is not miles away up in the sky, but is, so to speak, God's dimension of the cosmos. And I think that's something that comes through in Copeland's fiction. The fear that God might have deliberately absented himself, a number of characters believe this in an earlier novel, Hey Nostradamus, about a school shooting, a really theologically solemn novel, like The Lovely Bones, begins with a narrator who's already dead, who's already been murdered in her late teens. She's written on a binder just before she dies the phrase, God is nowhere, with a slash after it, God is now here. So this theological conundrum emblematizes the novel's focus on the possibility or otherwise of belief in a benevolent, loving God and a powerful God, or a powerful God who isn't really interested in the evil that happens in this world. As Brian Draper's observed, Cheryl's overinterpreted epigram not only relies on a space for its impact, but also symbolizes the gap between God's seemingly random presence and absence in a hurting world. And it's that kind of difference, that kind of ambiguity that most seems to interest Copeland, I think. Although Hey Nostradamus avoids tidy answers, I think it is an incredibly powerful novel of the search for God, of the hope of heaven as well. Is there such a thing as resurrection? And those visions of the future, in fact, go way back to his first novel, Generation X, another novel that's featured on, I think, in the top 10 of Greenbelter's favourite novels. How many of you voted in that? Altogether, I'm not sure. I think it might have been as many as 1,000 people. But Copeland does seem to resonate with what people are interested in. He does seem to have defined things in all sorts of ways. In one of his early novels, Shampoo Planet, where we get a guy who's utterly enthralled, if you like, to materialism. And he's a likeable character, but has no interest in spirituality. At one point in the novel, his life is kind of hijacked, to use a phrase, by a vision of judgment on Earth. He sees visions of cities so big and so dead as to have their own complete cosmologies of the afterworld. I envisage screaming housewife mummies in pearls, dog paddling in the molten coke lakes of the anti-Pittsburgh. You've got to worry about Copeland sometimes if you can create that kind of vision. It's this kind of daydream vision. It's a logic that infects a number of the novels. In Microsurfs as well, for example, the narrator, Dan Underwood, who consciously from the first few pages says what he's looking for in his friends is ideas of the afterlife. What do they believe? But it's something they consistently avoid. Do we have any belief in that? Is that why we have big corporations and guru figures like Bill Gates, for whom he works early on? Is that a kind of replacement for God because we always need God? He has a similar kind of vision of this world coming to an end. But significantly, in one of Copeland's most recent novels, in fact, his most recently published novel, J-Pod, Copeland's thematic sequel to Microsoft, is also set in the world of information technology. All belief in the future as a space that will be better, happier, more important and significant than today has evaporated. One minor character, it says this: I don't believe in the future. I think we're all doomed. He's convinced that civilization will soon end as a result either of global warming, terrorist activity, or a deadly virus. Or perhaps a deadly mélange of all three. I guess he'd be at home here. J-Pod explores the disappointments of living in an era in which the idea of a future, the kind of secular idea of a future as progress, that things are always going to be getting better, that we're going to have spacesuits. It's the year 2007, I want my spacesuit. As Homer says, I want my jetpack, where is it? That version of the future always fails us, doesn't it? We have more technology, somehow it doesn't satisfy us. And J-Pod really is about the failure of that. I think similar apocalyptic fears are pursued in a number of his other novels. Life After God, for example, has a specific vision of heaven. Significantly, that does come immediately after the Cold War fantasy of the four-minute warning. There's a story called The Wrong Son, followed by The Dead Speak. And in The Dead Speak, people narrate how they died, sitting in ordinary office blocks, suddenly seeing the person next to them burst into flame. It's a very 1980s vision of the end of the world. Those of you who grew up in that time will probably remember having nightmares of that. And Copeland is kind of tapping into that sort of fear. But he's doing something interesting with it. He's not leaving it there. He's taking it somewhere else. One of the characters who's died says this: it is much later on now. Please take your breath. For breath is what you require. Oxygen, light, and water. And time. But not us. We're no longer with you. We're no longer part of the living. The birds are here with us now. This is where they all went. And the fish in the sea, and the plants, and all of God's fine animals. It's cooler here too, and it is quiet. And we're changed souls. We don't look at things the same way anymore. For there was once a time when we expected the worst. But then the worst happened, did it not? And so we will never be surprised ever again. It's an extraordinarily audacious piece of writing, that, daring to imagine the future life in this way that, again, somehow, like that poem we started with, avoids cliché. Somehow it takes cliché and twists it, turns it into something else. There are plenty of books and films in the 80s and early 90s that dealt with apocalypse. Few of them dared to go there next. It's a weird kind of fusion. So we might regard it either, as I do, as kind of audacious or as an evasion of reality. I suppose some critics think that what Copeland does is to deny the political. Instead of finding political solutions to this kind of thing, he, like so many other writers, has given up on that and has bought into something spiritual as an alternative. I'm not sure we need to work with that kind of binary opposition, actually. I think we can still work for a better world here on Earth, as well as believing. In fact, we can be inspired by our visions of heaven, can we not? Girlfriend in a Coma, the number one book of Greenbelt, is apparently, is where I'm going to finish up. I think that's his most daring representation of heaven in ordinary, even more so than The Dead Speak. It might even come from that. For Robert McGill, this strange fable, however, is not apocalyptic, but rather is a response to apocalyptic literature. There's a kind of self-consciousness about it. All sorts of 90s texts and films and so on, like The X-Files, feed into it. Maybe even the kind of madness of American evangelical literature feeds into it. Sorry, I know I said that in a very objective way. But maybe that does shape what he's trying to do as a kind of alternative. But for all the novel parodies, end-time fantasies, as we might call them, that are themselves very politicised, he's tapping into something much earlier. As Jason Cowley notes, the novel explores the longing for a great cleansing act that may redeem humanity and allow all of us to start again, unchained from history. So for those of you who don't know, the novel starts in 1979, and a character called Karen, whose boyfriend is called Richard, they're named for the Carpenters. Oddly, there are all these references to pop culture within the text. Karen, age 17, after having sex the first time, slips into a coma. So don't do it, kids. And it lasts 17 years. And that's the extraordinary thing, that she wakes up. And actually, there's another conceit here, because she's got to live through the 80s. She's missed things like the advent of AIDS, the end of the Cold War, and so on. But the world is a much more bewildering place. We don't no longer know who our enemies are. That's the whole idea. But at the end of the novel, or the last third of the novel, if that weren't miracle enough, and I know there's been a recent ITV drama that's used that idea of somebody who's just missed 17 years, if that weren't miracle enough, and it is a kind of medical miracle, it's something that wouldn't have happened really until the latter part of the 20th century. That's something Copeland's interested in, the way technology shapes the way we live our lives. The novel at the end takes on this fable-like quality, as everybody else in the world, apart from Karen and her immediate group of friends, also slip into a coma that leads to death, and the world is just littered with decaying corpses. That idea of global catastrophe, again, it resonates with what Detweiler's called theological trends, the idea that an end is coming, some kind of end is coming. We got loads of 90s movies, didn't we, like Armageddon, in which Bruce Willis saves the world, Event Horizon. No, not Event Horizon. The one with Morgan Freeman in. I blocked it out in terms of the title. But the world ends once more, temporarily, but it's kind of very quickly redeemed. So they don't really have the courage of their convictions. And Girlfriend in a Coma sort of does. We have this divine figure, Jared, a 17-year-old who's been at school with him, who's died. He isn't a particularly religious figure, again, in life, but he becomes an angel of warning, a kind of divine witness, who tells his friends, who at the end of history, instead of suddenly repenting, actually just spend their time doing what the rest of us do, consuming, stealing. They steal gold and so on. They're surrounded by cash. They don't get it. At the end, they repent. They change. And they're granted a description of heaven. One character, in fact, is given a vision of heaven that blinds him, much like Saul on the road to Damascus. And this is what Jared says of heaven. Heaven's like the world at its finest. It's all natural, no buildings. It's built of stars and roots and mud. There's a bit of Greenbelt again there. And flesh and snakes. I don't think I'd like that. And birds. It's built of clouds and stones and rivers and lava. But it's not a building. So this image recalls the vision of paradise shed in the wrong sun, that kind of natural space that the narrator ends up in. And the end of another one of his novels called Shampoo Planet, I've mentioned already, which has a kind of baptismal ending in which the natural world breaks through into the cultural world. And it contradicts another idea that Copeland sort of detects as one of the phenomena of the 20th century, and particularly in America. And he uses L.A. As an example of this, the kind of the perfect suburbs around L.A. that contrast to the kind of hell on earth of some of those suburbs, that the kind of poorer places. The idea that heaven is manufacturable, undermines that idea. It suggests we need visions of it, but actually it's not something we achieve on earth as such. Neither the artistic imagination nor religious faith can really offer us visions of alternate worlds as a substitute for this one, argues Robert Detweiler. For what they show us is simply a fuller, more affirmative vision of our own present world. Can we judge, as Copeland implies, a society or an individual on the basis of its ability to envision a life beyond the present? If heaven is knowable only via dream, prophecy, and speculation, these narratives, comic or elegant, bound up in the limits of the historical moment, might help audiences and readers to recuperate a sense of future hope. Fiction cannot replace the ongoing need for spiritual vision. I think we can't turn it into a kind of fetish, a kind of idol. We do so at our own peril. But it can, in the unlikely shapes imagined on the printed page or projected by the temporary light of a cinema screen, sustain the quest to rediscover paradise. Thanks very much. That's enough from me. I think we should have time for some questions that I'll do my best to answer. It'd be really good if there was at least one, otherwise I'll be really, really ashamed.
Thanks. I was just wondering, you've talked about the trends you see operating in film and in fiction. Do you think the same trends operate in poetry and in drama and other genres, or is there a kind of divergence?
I can't say with any authority how important it is within poetry and drama. I mean, that might sound ludicrous in a sense. What's the difference between them? I've just been so incredibly focused on film and fiction in recent years. But I think it is there as whispers. One of my colleagues at Lancaster, Paul Farley, who, to my knowledge, doesn't have a particular faith, is fascinated in those kind of questions. And he wrote a really significant poem called God a year or two ago that appeared in The Guardian and I think is in his most recent collection called Tramp in Flames. I'm not on a percentage for that, honestly. But so figures like Paul, I think, are interested in it. And in drama, I think the late Sarah Kane. You know, Sarah Kane was from an evangelical background and it keeps on coming back in her work. But I'm afraid I can't answer that with any real degree of authority, I'm sorry.
I was wondering how modern the trend is to have people getting to heaven and then it being a developing process. Once they've reached heaven, it's not sort of a Dante thing where you're fixed in a place, but you've actually, like Lovely Bones or something where, yeah, you know, heaven progresses. How modern is that? Is that a recent sort of more...
In a sense, I think it's modern in terms of fiction because it's about the influence of Eastern spiritualities as well as anything else. It's very different, I think, to the visions of heaven we might get in Jewish and Christian tradition. Again, I think it's something that's relatively new. It's only something I've been aware of. If there are any 17th century scholars here who want to contradict me, that's fine. But I think it is something that's quite peculiar to the post-World War, kind of more globalised context in which those, say, I guess Hindu ideas and Buddhist ideas come to pervade. Something like What Dreams May Come starts off looking very Christian or Jewish, and I think it becomes something quite different, for example, because reincarnation is on the table. So I think it is relatively new.
It is it relatively new, or is it a rediscovery of the tradition represented somehow by purgatory? Because when I was reading Five People You Meet in Heaven, I was struck that I wasn't sure whether this was heaven or whether this was purgatory.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about a Catholic influence, and particularly Dante, and Dante's not somebody I really talked about today. I mean, there's not time and world enough at that sense. But yes, a notion of progress, I suppose. I mean, purgatory as an idea, does it still have any kind of status outside the Catholic Church? I don't know, in a sense that it does. Maybe the way in which a lot of us see heaven is much more like a kind of purgatory, something kind of transient, I don't know. But yes, I mean, we need to go back to medieval literature to think about that. But I think that's to do with the loss of certain kinds of tradition. And when we reimagine them, what do we end up with? You know, which figures stay with us? And so in some ways, it's the oldest ones that are still there. I think that there are ideas from early in the 20th century that are lost very quickly. Demythologized Christianity, for example, you know, doesn't always have that kind of force where all of this is a fiction. You don't believe in any of it as possible, or even as kind of impossible but possible with God. I don't think those kind of ideas necessarily have the same kind of force that maybe much older visions have.
Yeah, you can kind of multiply examples endlessly, but it was interesting that Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale came quite high, and I wonder if that's got something to do with it being a set book. If I had to pick an Atwood on your topic, it would be something more like Oryx and Crake, where there's an attempt to create heaven that kind of turns into hell in an interesting way.
Yes.
Yeah. And similarly, if we're looking at Tarantino's Pulp Fiction, which is, you know, I've never seen a clearer depiction of an angel than Mr. Wolfe.
Right, okay.
Really interesting. But one of the others, Philip Pullman, who you didn't mention, and he takes the idea of the kingdom of heaven, which is not quite what you're on, I know, but from the Bible, and develops in an extended way this very interesting notion of the Republic of Heaven,
yes,
which seems more complete and in some ways more attractive than any of the notions of heaven you've talked about. I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think Philip Pullman is misrepresented, not least by himself, actually, because I think that you know, the fiction gets away from his own kind of hard-headed Darwinian or Dawkins-esque rationalism. I think the books do provide a very powerful idea, you know, of heaven as something being much more kind of inclusive and strange and beautiful than so many other, you know, Christian attempts to produce that, partly because it gets away from cliché. But I guess that's to do with, you know, the purpose of story. If we believe in this meta-narrative of creation and fall and redemption, it's going to infuse even those ones that try and write against those. So I guess that's where I'd see Pullman. And even his desire to kill off God, you know, he's killing off an idol in a sense, isn't he? And I know people like Rowan Williams have addressed that very clearly. But I think that's a really good example. Pullman was somebody I could have spent the entire time talking about, in a sense, and so avoided. That's a good question.
You've gone to the top 10 books that Greenbelt have voted for. I'd read one of them. At number 10, Terry Pratchett, The Colour of Magic. And Terry Pratchett writes books about death. There are demons. Several characters actually go to hell at various stages in stories as well. He even has scenes that happen after you die, when there's some form of process where you meet death before you go. But he never writes what happens to the people who don't end up in hell. Why do you think it's acceptable, in this case, a fantasy genre, to write about demons, hell, and all the rest of death, but there's nothing talked at all about the other side?
I think that's, in a sense, where I started, because I suppose with hell you have tension, a little bit of tension. You have drama. You have the possibility of, I suppose, somebody in that world escaping its clutches. But with heaven, I suppose, heaven is literally the end of stories. It's the end of the story, I suppose. That's one way of looking at it. With Pratchett, I mean, I think because, you know, he is working within this continuum of fantasy rather than realism, he can do all of that. He can play with the supernatural ideas to his own kind of satirical end, if you like. And I guess what would be interesting is if he tried to write a drama of heaven. I guess the kind of undergraduate question is that there are no stories in heaven discussed. But I'm not going to set you homework. You know, it's sunny. Yeah, I guess that's what I'd say.
Yes, I'd just like to pick up on the reference of to the Margaret Atwood, Oryx and Craig. I'd like your comments on that, if you wouldn't mind. Thank you.
It wouldn't be the first book that I've not read that I've talked about. so I can't talk about it in any detail, apart from the fact that I know it is much, very much part of that kind of scientific dystopian tradition. I don't know if anybody in the audience wants to say why they think it's significant theologically. I mean, maybe you've got something you might want to add. Anybody else? I'm sorry to let you down there. Somebody there, just in the middle.
How do you think the visions of C.S. Lewis, for instance, in The Last Battle have lasted? After all, that was written in the 1950s, and a lot of the fiction you've discussed has been since then, hasn't it? The Last Battle by C.S. Lewis?
Yeah, for a C.S. Lewis fan, as I am, The Last Battle is really impossible to talk about, but you have to talk about it, because I think it's one of the most offensive books in the English language, in a way. In some ways, I mean, in some ways there are, you know, very beautiful images going with Aslan further up and further in all of those kind of things. But the kind of, I think it's C.S. Lewis and the 1950s at its worst. There's a kind of joke about C.S. Lewis, isn't there, that he, C.S. Lewis is this kind of mystic figure who provides the answer to everything, but he shouldn't be confused with the Oxford and Cambridge Don of the same name. And I think, you know, in a way, he's just a person of his time, because there's a strong racial dimension to it. It seems to be, to get into a kingdom of heaven, you don't have to be just be like a little child. You have to be a child. You're not permitted to grow up, and so on. So I think it's hugely problematic that, I mean, you know, I love the other books in the series. I'm quite happy for people to tell me I'm being blinkered and kind of right on about it. But I do find it a very, very difficult book in different ways. I think endings are the big problem of literature always, aren't they? How do you, end seven books, as J.K. Rowling did recently? And I'm not going to say anything about that now. I guess I'd be killed by anybody who hadn't. I would have killed anybody who gave the ending away. but it's difficult, isn't it, finding an end point? And I guess he comes up against that, you know, how do you represent heaven theologically? So I think it's a kind of blind spot in his work. I mean, that's my personal 21st century prejudiced opinion of that.
What did you think of his depiction of Susan, the sister who doesn't make it into heaven because she's not childlike enough?
Yeah, I mean, because she's grown up, she doesn't get into heaven. I'm with Philip Pullman on that. I think it's a kind of odd idea. You understand what he's trying to do, to talk about people who've kind of lost all sense of what's important. But it's an extraordinarily punitive measure and kind of weird, I think, for a kind of 50-odd-year-old man to be talking about a young woman in that kind of way. So I find it kind of distasteful. And I think I'd never got over reading it when I was a child. I'm still cross with C.S. Lewis for that. So that's just my personal issue, perhaps.
Hi, we've talked about future visions of heaven, but in all the work that you've cited, as far as I'm aware, I'm still unclear yet what the criteria might be to actually get to one of these utopian ideals that you've been describing. Can you shed any light on that?
Yeah, so the person I know asks me the hardest question. That's great. I don't know that any of these novelists necessarily offer a kind of way in, as it were, because human ways to heaven, either on earth or as a kind of spiritual idea in these texts, tend to fail. They tend to come to pieces. And in some ways, it's a critique of what we might call the kind of Gnostic turn, that the belief, the spiritual belief that somehow knowledge will, a secret knowledge as well, will get you somewhere. And I think in Copeland, it's interesting because an act of repentance and an act, in fact, of atonement, I mean, problematically, but interestingly, is necessary for the resurrection of the human race. I found that very, very powerful in a text that otherwise doesn't necessarily wear its interests, its theological interests, on its sleeve.
We'll have to make this the last question. Thanks.
You mentioned that heaven is often seen as a sort of a boring place where nothing happens. And I'm just interested why hell's been portrayed as an interesting place where stuff does happen, because presumably if you're considering either one of them, then you've got to say they work along the same lines, that they're both cyclical and would go on and on, and there wouldn't be a chance to sort of get out of that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge theological question, isn't it, about the, you know, hell and whether it's eternal torment or annihilation or whatever it is, and not one I really feel qualified to answer. I mean, I suppose what we've got is human beings imagining those kind of spaces for all sorts of other reasons than thinking about what it might be like. I mean, I think quite often it's charged with a political idea. Even somebody like Dante wasn't just writing about the next world, he was writing about this one too, and the kind of political corruption of his own historical moment. In terms of heaven being a kind of dull place, I think that's just to do with limits of the human imagination as well, and kind of cliches as well, to do with, in some ways, we're bullied by the great pieces of Renaissance art, aren't we? You know, they're kind of awe-inspiring on one hand, but they seem to set a limit on our own imagination. So we don't go back to the Gospels, and we don't think about the extraordinary images that Christ gives that are kind of utterly confound our expectations, to do with the last being first and so on, and the strange metaphors that he uses. We maybe go to Revelation and think about those very charged images, but our ability to understand those, I think, is always limited. Even the best writers have difficulty. So I think it's to do with the limits of the human imagination as much as anything else. Okay. Thanks very much. You've been really kind.